Chapter 33 of The String of Pearls. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Hui Jing. The String of Pearls. Author unknown. Chapter 33. The Discoveries of the Vaults of St. Dunstan's. Well, Sir Richard, remarked the beadle of St. Dunstan's to the magistrate, after the ponderous stone was raised in the center of the church, upon which the workmen had been busy. Don't you smell nothing now? The magistrate, church wardens, and indeed everyone present, shrank back from the horrible stench that saluted them, now that the stone was fairly removed. Why, good God, exclaimed the senior church warden, have we been sitting and hearing sermons with such a charnel house under? I always understood that none of the vaults exactly underneath the church had been used for many years past. Hush, said the magistrate. The inquiry we are upon is perhaps a more important one than you imagine, sir. More important? How can that be? Didn't the bishop smell it when he came to confirm the people? And didn't he say in the vestry that he could not confirm anybody while such a smell was in the church? And didn't we tell him that it would be a sad thing if he didn't? And then he did confirm the people in such a twinkling that they didn't know what they were confirmed in at all. Hush, my good sir, hush and hear me. Would you? Now that you have got up this great stone and opened, as I see, the top of a stone staircase, by so doing, send away the workmen, and indeed, all persons but yourself and me. Well, but you don't mean us to go down, sir, do you? I mean to go, you may depend. Send away the men at once, if you please. I have ample warrant for all I am about to do, I assure you. I suspect I shall be well able to free St. Dunstan's church from the horrible stench that has been infesting it for some time past. You think so, sir? Bless you, then. I'll do just whatever you like. The workmen were not sorry to be dismissed from the uncomfortable employment. But the beadle, who was holding his nose, and who, having overheard what Sir Richard had said, was extremely anxious upon the subject, put in his claim to stay, on the ground of being one of the officials of the church, and he was accordingly permitted to stay. This seems to lead to the vaults, remarked Sir Richard, as he looked down the chasm, which the removal of the stone had left. Yes, replied the churchwarden, it does, and they have, as I say, been unused for a long time. But how that dreadful smell can come from bodies that have been 40 or 50 years there, I can't think. We must be careful of the foul air, remarked the magistrate. Get a torch, Mr. Beadle, if you please, and we will lower it into the vault. If that leaves, we can, and if you please go first to the door of the church and take this silk handkerchief with you, and hold it up in your hand, and upon that signal, 4 persons will come to you. They are officers of mine, and you will bring them to me. Oh dear, yes, certainly, said the beadle, who was quite happy at the thought of such a reinforcement. I'll do it, sir. And as for a torch, there is some famous length in the vestry cupboard, as I'll get in a minute. Well, I do think the smell is a little better already, don't you, sir? I'm a-going. Don't be impatient, sir. I'm going like a shot. I am.
To give the beadles his due, he certainly executed his orders quickly. The 4 officers, sure enough, obeyed the signal of the handkerchief, and in a few minutes more, a torchlight was lowered by a rope down a gloomy aperture. all watched the light with great interest as it descended. But although it certainly burned dimmer than before, yet it showed no sign of going out. And the magistrate said, "We may safely descend. The air that will support flame will likewise support animal life. Therefore, we need be under no sort of apprehension. Follow me." He commenced a careful descent to the stone steps, and was promptly followed by his four men, and much more slowly by the beadle and the churchwarden, neither of whom seemed much to relish the adventure, although their curiosity prompted them to continue it. The stone steps consist of about 20, and when the bottom was gained, it was found to be covered with flat stones of considerable size, upon which sawdust was strewn, but not sufficiently thickly to cover them in all places completely. There was a death-like stillness in the place, and the few crumbling coffins which were in niches in the walls were with their tenants, evidently too old to give forth that frightful odor of animal decomposition which pervaded the place. "You will see, Sir Richard," said the churchwarden, producing a piece of paper, "that according to the plan of the vaults I have here, this one opens to a passage that runs halfway round the church, and from that passage opens a number of vaults, not one of which has been used for years past." "I see the door is open." "Yes, it is as you say." "That's odd, Sir Richard. And it?" "Oh, gracious! Just put your head out into the passage, and won't you smell it then?" They all tried the experiment, and found, indeed, that the smell was horrible. Sir Richard took a torch from one of the constables and advanced into the passage. He could see nothing but the door of some of the vaults open. He crossed the threshold of one of them, and was away about a minute, after which he came back, saying, "I think we will all retire now. We have seen enough to convince us all about it."
"All about it, sir?" said the churchwarden. "What about it?"
"Exactly. That will do. Follow me, my man." The officers, without the slightest questions or remarks, followed Sir Richard, and he began rapidly, with them at his heels, to ascend the stone staircase into the church again.
"Hilloa!" cried the beadle. "I say, stop! Oh, Lord, don't let me be lost! Oh, don't! I shall think something horrible is coming up after me, and going to lay hold of my heels! Don't let me be lost! Oh, dear!"
"You can't be lost," said one of the officers. "You know, if anything is going to lay hold of your heels, take it easy. It is only a ghost at most, you know." By the time the beadle got fairly into the church, he was in that state of perspiration and fright that he was obliged to sit down upon the tomb to recover himself. And the magistrate took that opportunity of whispering to the churchwarden, "I want to speak to you alone. Come out with me." Order the church to be locked up, as if we meditated no further search in the vaults.
"Yes, oh yes, I knew there was some secret." "There is a horrible one, such a one as all London will ring within 24 hours more. Such a secret as will never be forgotten in connection with old St. Dunstan's church while it is in existence." There was a solemnity about the manners in which the magistrate spoke, which quite alarmed the churchwarden, and he turned rather pale as they stood upon the church threshold.
"Do you know one Sweeney Todd?" asked the magistrate.
"Oh, yes, a barber."
"Good. Incline your ear to me while we walk down to Downing Street.
I'm going to call upon the Secretary of State for the Home Department,
And before we get there, I shall be able to tell you why and what sort of assistance I want of you." The churchwarden did incline his ear most eagerly. But before they had got halfway down the strand, he was compelled to go into a public house to get some brandy. Such an overpowering effect had the horrible communication of the magistrate upon him. What that communication was, we shall very soon discover, but it is necessary that we follow Mr. Todd a little in his proceedings after he left Johanna in charge of his shop. Todd walked briskly on till he came nearly to Pickett Street in the Strand, and then he went into a chemist's shop that was there, in which only a lad was serving. "You recollect," said Todd, "serving me with some red poison?"
"Oh, yes, yes, Mr. Todd, I believe.
The same, I want some more, for the fact is that owing to the ornament I have in my shop for the hair, the vermin are attracted, and I have now as many as ever. It was only last night I awakened, and saw one actually lapping up hair oil, and another drinking some rose water that they had upset and broken a bottle of. So I will thank you to give me some liquid poison, if you please, as they seemed so fond of drink."
"Exactly, sir, exactly," said the lad, as he took down a bottle and made up a portion. "Exactly, sir. If you put a few drops only of this in half a pint of liquid, it will do."
"A couple of drops? This must be powerful."
"It is, a dozen drops, or about half a teaspoonful, would kill a man to a certainty. So you will be careful of it, Mr. Todd. Of course, we don't sell such things to strangers, you know, but you being a neighbor alters the case."
"True enough. Thank you. Goodbye. I think we shall have rain shortly, do you know?" Todd walked away with the poison in his pocket, and when he had got a few yards from the chemist's door, he gave such a hideous chuckle that an old gentleman, who was close before him, ran like a lamb lighter in his fright, and put himself quite out of breath.
"This will do," muttered Todd. "I must smooth the path to my retirement from business. I know well that if I were to hint at such a thing in a certain quarter, it would be considered a certain proof that I have made enough to be worth dividing. And that is a process I don't intend exactly to go through. No, no, Mrs. Lovett, no, no." Todd marched slowly toward his own house, but when he got to the corner of Bell Yard and heard St. Dunstan strike 12, he paused a moment and then muttered, "I'll call and see her. Yes, I'll call and see her. The evening will answer better my present purpose." He then walked up Bell Yard until he came to the fascinating Mrs. Lovett's pie shop. He paused a moment at the window and leered in at two lawyer's clerks who were eating some of yesterday's pies. The warm day batch had not yet come up. "Happy youth," he chuckled, and walked into the shop. Mrs. Lovett received him graciously as an acquaintance, and invited him into the parlor, while the two limbs of the law continued eating and praising the pies.
"Delicious, ain't they?" said one.
"Oh, I believe you," replied the other. "And such jolly lots of gravy, too, and there? I wonder how she does make them. Lord bless you, I almost live upon them, you know. I used to take all my meals with my fat old uncle, Marsh, but since he disappeared one day, I live on Lovett's pies, instead of the old buffer." End of chapter 33. Recording by Hui Jin.
Chapter 34 of The String of Pearls. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Christine Blashford. The String of Pearls, Author Unknown. Chapter 34. Johanna Alone, The Secret Mr. Todd's Suspicions, The Mysterious Letter. For some time after Todd had left the shop, Johanna could scarcely believe that she was sufficiently alone to dare to look about her, but as minute after minute passed away and no sound indicative of his speedy return fell upon her ears, she gathered more courage. "Yes," she said, "I am at last alone, in the place where my suspicions have always pointed as the death-place of poor Mark. Oh, heavens grant that it may not be so, and that, in unravelling the evident mystery of this man's life, I may hail you living, my dear Mark, and not have to mourn you dead. And yet how can I, even for a moment, delude myself with such false hopes? No, no, he has fallen a victim to this ruthless man." For a few minutes, as Johanna gave way to this violent burst of grief, she wrung her hands and wept. But then, as a thought of the danger she would be in should Todd return and see signs of emotion crossed her mind, she controlled her tears and managed to bear the outward semblance of composure. She then began to look about her in the same way that poor Tobias had done, but she could find nothing of an explanatory character, although her suspicions made almost everything into grounds of suspicion. She looked into the cupboard, and there she saw several costly sticks and some umbrellas, and then she narrowly examined all the walls, but could see nothing indicative of another opening, save the door, visible and apparent. As she moved backwards, she came against the shaving chair, which she found was a fixture, as upon examination she saw that the legs of it were firmly secured to the floor. What there could be suspicious in such a circumstance she hardly knew, and yet it did strike her as such. "If I had but time," she thought, "I would make an attempt to go into that parlour, but I dare not yet. No, no, I must be more sure of the continued absence of Todd before I dare make any such attempt." As she uttered these words, someone opened the door cautiously, and peeping in said, "Is Mr. Todd at home?" "No," replied Johanna. "Oh, very good. Then you are to take this letter, if you please, and read it. You will find, I dare say, whom it's from when you open it. Keep it to yourself, though, and if Mr. Todd should come in, hide it, mind, whatever you do." Before Johanna could make any reply, the man disappeared, and great was her astonishment to read upon the outside of the letter that had been put into her hands her own proper name. With trembling fingers she opened it and read as follows. "From Sir Richard Blunt, Magistrate, to Miss Oakley. Miss Johanna Oakley, you have with great chivalry of spirit embarked in a very dangerous enterprise, an enterprise which, considering your youth and your sex, should have been left to others, and it is well that others are in a position to watch over you and ensure your safety. Your young friend, Arabella Wilmot, after giving so much romantic advice, and finding that you followed it, became herself alarmed at its possible consequences, and very prudently informed one who brought the intelligence to me, so that you are now well looked after. And should any danger present itself to you, you have but to seize any article that comes within your reach and throw it through a pane of glass in the shop window, when assistance will immediately come to you. I tell you this in order that you should feel quite at ease. As, however, you have placed yourself in your present position in Todd's shop, it is more than likely you will be able to do good service in aiding to unmask that villain. You will, therefore, be good enough, towards the dusk of the evening, to hold yourself in readiness to do anything required of you by anyone who shall pronounce to you the password of St. Dunstan. From your friend mentioned above." Johanna read this letter, certainly with most unmitigated surprise, and yet there was a glow of satisfaction in her mind as she perused it, and the difference in her feelings, now that she was assured of protection, was certainly something wonderful and striking. To think that she had but to seize any one of the numerous stray articles that lay about and fling it through the window in order to get assistance was a most consolatory idea, and she felt nerved for almost any adventure. She had just hidden the letter when Sweeney Todd made his appearance. "Anybody been?" he asked. "Yes, one man, but he would not wait." "Ah, wanted to be shaved, I suppose, but no matter, no matter. And I hope you have been quiet and not been attempting to indulge your curiosity in any way since I have been gone. Hush, there's somebody coming. Why, it's old Mr. Rankley, the tobacconist, I declare. Good day to you, sir. Shaved, I suppose? I'm glad you have come, sir, for I have been out till this moment. Hot water, Charlie, directly, and hand me that razor." Johanna, in handing Todd the razor, knocked the edge of it against the chair, and it being uncommonly sharp, cut a great slice of the wood off one of the arms of it. "What shameful carelessness," said Todd. "I have half a mind to lay the strop over your back, sir. Here you have spoiled a capital razor, not a bit of edge left upon it." "Oh, excuse him, Mr. Todd, excuse him," said the old gentleman. "He's only a little lad, after all. Let me intercede for him." "Very good, sir. If you wish me to look over it, of course I will, and thank God we have a stock of razors, of course, always at hand. Is there any news stirring, sir?" "Nothing that I know of, Mr. Todd, except it's the illness of Mr. Cummings, the overseer. They say he got home about 12 to his own house in Chancery Lane, and ever since then he has been sick as a dog, and all they can get him to say is, 'Oh, those pies, those pies.'"
"Very odd, sir."
"Very. I think Mr. Cummings must be touched in the upper story, do you know, Mr. Todd? He's a very respectable man, but between you and I was never very bright."
"Certainly not, certainly not. But it's a very odd case. What pies can he possibly mean, sir? Did you call when you came from home?"
"No, I can't help laughing, but I have come away from home on the sly, you see. The fact is, my wife's cousin, Mr. Mundell. Hello, I think you have cut me."
"No, no, we can't cut anybody for 3 halfpence, sir."
"Oh, very good, very good. Well, as I was saying, my wife's cousin, Mr. Mundell, came to our house last night and brought with him a string of pearls, you see. He wanted me to go to the city this morning with them to Round and Bridget, the court jewellers, and ask them if they had ever seen them before."
"Were they beauties?"
"Yes, they are brilliant ones. You see, Mundell lends money, and he didn't like to go himself, so he asked me to go, as Mr. Round knows me very well. For between you and me, Mr. Todd, my wife's cousin, Mr. Mundell, thinks they belonged once upon a time to some lady."
"Oh, indeed."
"Yes, and as it won't do to say too much to women, I told my wife I was going over the water, you see, and just popped out. And I've got the pearls in my pocket. Mundell says they are worth £12,000 at the least."
"Indeed, sir, £12,000, a pretty sum that, sir, a very pretty sum. No doubt Mr. Mundell lent £7,000 or £8,000 upon the pearls. I think I will just give you another lather, sir, before I polish you off, and so you have the pearls with you. Well, how odd things come round, to be sure."
"What do you mean?"
"This shaving brush is just in a good state now, always as a shaving brush is on the point of wearing out. It's the best. Charlie, you will go at once to Mr. Cummings and ask if he is any better. You need not hurry, that's a good lad. I am not at all angry with you now."
"And so, sir, they think at home that you have gone after some business over the water, do they, and have not the least idea that you have come here to be shaved. There, be off, Charlie. Shut the door, that's a good lad. Bless you."
When Johanna came back, the tobacconist was gone.
"Well," said Sweeney Todd, as he sharpened a razor very leisurely, "how is Mr. Cumming?"
"I found out his house, sir, with some difficulty, and they say he is better, having gone to sleep."
"Oh, very good. I am going to look over some accounts in the parlour, so don't choose to be disturbed, you understand? And for the next 10 minutes, if anybody comes, you will say I am out."
Sweeney Todd walked quite coolly into the parlour, and Johanna heard him lock the door on the inside. A strange, undefined sensation of terror crept over her. She knew not why, and she shuddered as she looked around her. The cupboard door was not close shut, and she knew not what prompted her to approach and peep in. On the first shelf was the hat of the tobacconist. It was a rather remarkable one, and recognised in a moment.
"What has happened? Good God, what can have happened?" thought Johanna, as she staggered back until she reached the shaving-chair, into which she cast herself for support. Her eyes fell upon the arm which she had taken such a shaving off with the razor, but all was perfectly whole and correct. There was not the least mark of the cut that so recently had been given to it, and lost in wonder, Johanna, for more than a minute, continued looking for the mark of the injury she knew could not have been, by any possibility, effaced. And yet she found it not, although there was the chair just as usual, with its wide-spreading arms and its worn, tarnished paint and gilding. No wonder that Johanna rubbed her eyes and asked herself if she were really awake. What could account for such a phenomenon? The chair was a fixture, too, and the others in the shop were of a widely different make and construction, so it could not have been changed. "Alas, alas," mourned Johanna, "my mind is full of horrible surmise, and yet I can form no rational conjecture. I suspect everything and know nothing. What can I do? What ought I to do to relieve myself from this state of horrible suspense? Am I really in a place where, by some frightful ingenuity, murder has become bold and familiar, or can it all be a delusion?" She covered her face with her hands for a time, and when she uncovered them, she saw that Sweeney Todd was staring at her with looks of suspicion from the inner room. The necessity of acting her part came over Johanna, and she gave a loud scream. "What the devil is all this about?" said Todd, advancing with a sinister expression. "What's the meaning of it? I suspect..." "Yes, sir," said Johanna, "and so do I. I must tomorrow have it out."
"Have what out?"
"My tooth, sir. It's been aching for some hours. Did you ever have the toothache? If you did, you can feel for me, and not wonder that I lean my head upon my hands and groan." End of chapter 34.
Chapter 35 of The String of Pearls. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Jason Mayoff. The String of Pearls. Author unknown. Chapter 35. Todd was but half satisfied with this excuse of Master Charlie's, and yet it was one he could not very well object to,
and might be true. So, after looking at Joanna for some moments, suspiciously, he thought he might take it upon trust. "Well, well," he said, "no doubt you will be better tomorrow. There's your sixpence for today. Go and get yourself some dinner. And the cheapest thing you can do is to go to Lovett's pie shop with it." "Thank you, sir." Joanna was aware as she walked out of the shop that the eyes of Sweeney Todd were fixed upon her, and that if she betrayed, by even the remotest gesture, that she had suspicions of him, probably he would prevent her exit. So she kept herself seemingly calm and went out very slowly. But it was a great relief to gain the street and feel that she was not under the same roof with that dreadful and dreaded man. Instead of going to Lovett's pie shop, Joanna turned into a pastry cook's near at hand and partook of some refreshments. And while she is doing so, we will go back again and take a glance at Sweeney Todd as he sat in his shop alone. There was a look of great triumph on his face, and his eyes sparkled with an unwonted brilliance. It was quite clear that Sweeney Todd was deeply congratulating himself upon something, and at length, diving his hand into the depths of a huge pocket, he produced the identical string of pearls for which he had already received so large a sum from Mr. Mundell. "Truly," he said, "I must be one of fortune's prime favorites indeed. Why, this string of pearls to me is a continued fortune. Who could have for one moment dreamed of such a piece of rare fortune? I need not now be at all suspicious or troubled concerning John Mundell. He has lost his pearls and lost his money. Ha, ha, ha. That is glorious. I will shut up shop sooner than I intended by far and be off to the continent. Yes, my next sale of the string of pearls shall be in Holland." With the pearls in his hand, Todd now appeared to fall into a very distracted train of thought, which lasted him about 10 minutes, and then some accidental noise in the street or the next house jarred upon his nerves, and he sprang to his feet, exclaiming, "What's that? What's that?" All was still again, and he became reassured. "What a fool I get," he muttered to himself, "that every casual sound disturbs me and causes this tremor. It is time, now that I am getting nervous, that I should leave England. But first I must dispose of one whose implacable disposition I know well, and who would hunt me to the farthest corner of the earth if she were not at peace in the grave. Yes, the peace of the grave must do for her. I can think of no other mode of silencing so large a claim." As he spoke those words, he took from his pocket the small packet of poison that he had purchased, and held it up between him and the light with a self-satisfied expression. Then he rose hastily, for he had again seated himself, and walked to the window as if he were anxious for the return of Joanna, in order that he might leave the place. As he waited, he saw a young girl approach the shop, and having entered it, she said, "Mrs. Lovett's compliments, Mr. Todd, and she has sent you this note, and will be glad to see you at 8 o'clock this evening." "Oh, very well, very well. Why, Lucy, you look prettier than ever." "It's more than you do, Mr. Todd," said the girl, as she left, apparently in high indignation that so ugly a specimen of humanity as Sweeney Todd should have taken it upon himself to pay her a compliment. Todd only gave a hideous sort of grin, and then he opened the letter, which had been brought to him. It was without signature and contained the following words: "The new cook is already tired of his place, and you must tonight make another vacancy. He is the most troublesome one I have had, because the most educated. He must be got rid of. You know how. I am certain mischief will come of it." "Indeed," said Todd, when he finished this epistle, "this is quick. Well, well, we shall see, we shall see. Perhaps we shall get rid of more than one person who otherwise would be troublesome tonight. But here comes my new boy. He suspects nothing." Joanna returned, and Todd asked somewhat curiously about the toothache. However, she bade him so apparently calm and cool a reply that he was completely foiled, and fancied that his former suspicions must surely have had no real foundation, but had been provoked merely by his fears. "Charlie," he said, "you will keep an eye on the door, and when anyone wants me, you will pull that spring, which communicates with a bell that will make me hear. I am merely going to my bedroom." "Very well, sir." Todd gave another suspicious glance at her, and then left the shop. She had hoped that he would have gone out, so that there would have been another opportunity, and a better one than the last, of searching the place. But in that she was disappointed, and there was no recourse but to wait with patience. The day was on the decline, and a strong impression came over Joanna's mind that something in particular would happen before it wholly passed away into darkness. She almost trembled to think what that something could be, and that she might be compelled to be a witness to violence from which her gentle spirit revolted. And had it not been that she had determined nothing should stop her from investigating the fate of poor Mark and Gestry, she could even then have rushed into the street in despair. But as the soft daylight deepened into the dim shadows of evening, she grew more composed and was better able, with a calmer spirit, to await the progress of events. Objects were but faintly discernible in the shop when Sweeney Todd came downstairs again, and he ordered Joanna to light a small oil lamp which shed but a very faint and sickly ray around it, and by no means facilitated the curiosity of anyone who might wish to peep in at the window. "I am going out," he said. "I shall be gone an hour, but not longer. You may say so to anyone who calls." "I will, sir." "Be vigilant, Charlie, and your reward is certain." "I pray to heaven it may be," said Joanna, when she was again alone. But scarcely had the words passed her lips when a hackney coach drove up to the door, and then alighted someone who came direct into the shop. He was a tall, gentlemanly-looking man, and before Joanna could utter a word, he said, "The watchword, Miss Oakley, is St. Dunstan. I am a friend." Oh, how delightful it was to Joanna to hear such words, oppressed as she was by the fearful solitude of that house. She sprang forward, eagerly forward, saying, "Yes, yes, oh yes, I had the letter." "Hush, there is no time to lose. Is there any hiding place here at all?" "Oh yes, a large cupboard." "That will do. Wait here a moment while I bring in a friend of mine, if you please, Miss Oakley. We have got some work to do tonight." The tall man, who was as cool and collected as anyone might be, went to the door and presently returned with two persons, both of whom, it was found, might with very little trouble be hidden in the cupboard. Then there was a whispered consultation for a few minutes, after which the first corner turned to Joanna and said, "Miss Oakley, when do you expect Todd to return?" "In an hour." "Very well. As soon as he does return, I shall come in to be shaved, and no doubt you will be sent away. But do not go further than the door, whatever you do, as we may possibly want you. You can easily linger about the window." "Yes, yes, but why all this mystery? Tell me what it is that you mean by all this. Is there any necessity for keeping me in the dark about it?" "Miss Oakley, there is nothing exactly to tell you yet, but it is hoped that this night will remove some mysteries and open your eyes to many circumstances that at present you cannot see. The villainy of Sweeney Todd will be espied, and if there be any hope of your restoration to one in whom you feel a great interest, it will be by such means." "You mean Mark and Gestry?" "I do. Your history has been related to me." "And who are you? Why keep up to me a disguise if you were a friend?" "I am a magistrate, and my name is Blunt, so you may be assured that all that can be done shall be done. But hold, you spoke of coming here to be shaved. If you do, let me implore you not to sit in that chair. There is some horrible mystery connected with it, but what it is, I cannot tell. Do not sit in it." "I thank you for your caution, but it is to be shaved in that very chair that I came. I know there is a mystery connected with it, and it is in order that it should be no longer a mystery that I have resolved upon running what perhaps may be considered a little risk. But our further stay here would be imprudent. Now, if you please." These last words were uttered to the two officers that the magistrate had brought with him, and it was quite wonderful to see with what tact and precision they managed to wedge themselves into the cupboard, the door of which they desired Joanna to close upon them. And when she had done so and turned round, she found that the magistrate was gone. Joanna was in a great state of agitation, but still it was some comfort to her now to know that she was not alone, and that there were two strong and no doubt well-armed men ready to take her part should anything occur amiss. She was much more assured of her own safety, and yet she was much more nervous than she had been. She waited for Sweeney Todd and strove to catch the sound of his returning footstep, but she heard it not. And as that gentleman went about some rather important business, we cannot do better than follow him, and see how he progressed with it. When he left his shop, he went direct to Bellyard, although it was a little before the time named for his visit to Mrs. Lovett. End of chapter 35. Recording by Jason Mayoff. Montreal. JasonMayoff.com.
Chapter 36 of The String of Pearls. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Corrie Samuel. The String of Pearls. Author unknown. Chapter 36. The Last Batch of the Delicious Pies. It would have been clear to anyone who looked at Sweeney Todd as he took his route from his own shop in Fleet Street to Bell Yard, Temple Bar, that it was not to eat pies he went there. No, he was on very different thoughts indeed intent, and as he neared the shop of Mrs. Lovett, where those delicious delicacies were vended, there was such a diabolical expression upon his face that, had he not stooped like grim war to smooth his wrinkled form ere he made his way into the shop, he would, most unquestionably, have excited the violent suspicions of Mrs. Lovett that all was not exactly as it should be, and that the mysterious bond of union that held her and the barber together was not in that blooming state that it had been. When he actually did enter the shop, he was all sweetness and placidity. Mrs. Lovett was behind the counter, for it seldom happened that the shop was free of customers, for when the batches of hot pies were all over, there usually remained some which were devoured cold with avidity by the lawyer's clerks from the offices and chambers in the neighbourhood. But at 9 o'clock there was a batch of hot pies coming up, for of late Mrs. Lovett had fancied that between 8:30 and 9 there was a great turnout of clerks from Lincoln's Inn, and a pie became a very desirable and comfortable prelude to half price at the theatre or any other amusements of the 3 hours before midnight. Many people, too, liked them as a relish for supper, and took them home quite carefully. Indeed, in Lincoln's Inn, it may be said, that the affections of the clerks oscillated between Lovett's pies and sheep's heads, and it frequently so nicely balanced in their minds that the two attractions depended upon the toss-up of a halfpenny, whether to choose Sang Amory James's from Clare Market, or pies from Lovett's. Half and half washed both down equally well. Mrs. Lovett, then, may be supposed to be waiting for the 9 o'clock batch of pies, when Sweeney Todd, on this most eventful evening, made his appearance. Todd and Mrs. Lovett met now with all the familiarity of old acquaintance. "Ah, Mr. Todd," said the lady, "how do you do? Why, we have not seen you for a long time." "It has been some time, and how are you, Mrs. Lovett?"
"Quite well, thank you. Of course, you will take a pie?"
Todd made a horrible face, as he replied, "No, thank you. It's very foolish when I knew I was going to make a call here, but I have just had a pork chop."
"Had it the kidney in it, sir?" asked one of the lads who were eating cold pies.
"Yes, it had."
"Oh, that's what I like. Lord bless you, I'd eat my mother if she was a pork chop, done brown and crisp and the kidney in it. Just fancy it, grilling hot, you know, and just popped on a slice of bread when you are cold and hungry."
"Will you walk in, Mr. Todd?" said Mrs. Lovett, raising a portion of the counter, by which an opening was made that enabled Mr. Todd to pass into the sacred precincts of the parlour. The invitation was complied with by Todd, who remarked that he hadn't above a minute to spare, but that he would sit down while he could stay, since Mrs. Lovett was so kind as to ask him. This extreme suavity of manner, however, left Sweeney Todd when he was in the parlour, and there was nobody to take notice of him but Mrs. Lovett, nor did she think it necessary to wreathe her face in smiles, but with something of both anger and agitation in her manner, she said,
"And when is all this to have an end, Sweeney Todd? You have been now for these 6 months providing me with such a division of spoil as shall enable me, with an ample independence, once again to appear in the salons of Paris. I ask you now, when is this to be?"
"You are very impatient."
"Impatient? Impatient? May I not well be impatient? Do I not run a frightful risk? While you must have the best of the profits. It is useless your pretending to tell me that you do not get much. I know you better, Sweeney Todd. You never strike, unless for profit or revenge.
Well?
Is it well, then, that I should have no account? Oh, God! If you had the dreams I sometimes have.
Dreams?
She did not answer him, but sank into a chair, and trembled so violently that he became alarmed, thinking she was very, very unwell. His hand was upon a bell-rope, when she motioned him to be still, and then she managed to say, in a very faint and nearly inarticulate voice, "You will go to that cupboard. You will see a bottle. I am forced to drink, or I should kill myself, or go mad, or denounce you. Give it to me. Quick, quick, give it to me. It is brandy. Give it to me, I say. Do not stand gazing at it there. I must, and I will have it. Yes, yes, I am better now, much better now. It is horrible, very horrible, but I am better, and I say I must, and I will have an account at once. Oh, Todd, what an enemy you have been to me."
"You wrong me. The worst enemy you ever had is in your head."
"No, no, no. I must have that to drown thought."
"Indeed. Can you be so superstitious? I presume you are afraid of your reception in another world."
"No, no. Oh, no. You and I do not believe in a hereafter, Sweeney Todd. If we did, we should go raving mad to think what we had sacrificed. Oh, no, no, we dare not. We dare not."
"Enough of this," said Todd, somewhat violently. "Enough of this. You shall have an account tomorrow evening. And when you find yourself in possession of £20,000, you will not accuse me of having been unmindful of your interests. But now there is someone in the shop who seems to be inquiring for you."
Mrs. Lovett rose and went into the shop. The moment her back was turned, Todd produced the little bottle of poison he had got from the chemist's boy, and emptied it into the brandy decanter. He had just succeeded in this manoeuvre, and concealed the bottle again, when she returned and flung herself into a chair.
"Did I hear you aright?" she said. "Or is this promise but a mere mockery? £20,000! Is it possible that you have so much? Oh, why was not all this dreadful trade left off sooner? Much less would have been done. But when shall I have it? When shall I be enabled to fly from here for ever? Todd, we must live in different countries. I could never bear the chance of seeing you."
"As you please. It doesn't matter to me at all. You may be off tomorrow night, if you like. I tell you, your share of the last 8 years' work shall be £20,000. You shall have the sum tomorrow, and then you are free to go where you please. It matters not to me one straw where you spend your money. But tell me now, what immediate danger do you apprehend from your new cook?"
"Great and immediate. He has refused to work, a sign that he has got desperate, hopeless and impatient. And then, only a few hours ago, I heard him call to me, and he said he had thought better of it, and would bake the 9 o'clock batch, which, to my mind, was saying that he had made up his mind to some course which gave him hope, and made it worth his while to temporise with me for a time, to lull suspicion."
"You are a clever woman. Something must and shall be done. I will be here at midnight, and we will see if a vacancy cannot be made in your establishment."
"It will be necessary, and it is but one more."
"That's all, that's all. And I must say you have a very perfect and philosophic mode of settling the question. Avoid the brandy as much as you can, but I suppose you are sure to take some between now and the morning."
"Quite sure. It is not in this house that I can wean myself of such a habit. I may do so abroad, but not here."
"Oh, well, it can't matter. But, as regards the fellow downstairs, I will, of course, come and rid you of him. You must keep a good lookout now for the short time you will be here, and a good countenance. There, you are wanted again, and I may as well go likewise."
Mrs. Lovett and Todd walked from the parlour to the shop together, and when they got there they found a respectable-looking woman and a boy, the latter of whom carried a bundle of printed papers with him. The woman was evidently in great distress of mind.
"Cold pie, ma'am?" said Mrs. Lovett.
"Oh, dear, no, Mrs. Lovett," said the woman. "I know you by sight, ma'am, though you don't know me. I am Mrs. Rankley, ma'am, the wife of Mr. Rankley, the tobacconist, and I've come to ask a favour of you, Mrs. Lovett, to allow one of these bills to be put in your window."
"Dear me," said Mrs. Lovett. "What's it about?"
Mrs. Rankly handed her one of the bills, and then seemed so overcome with grief that she was forced to sink into a chair while it was read, which was done aloud by Mrs. Lovett, who, as she did so, now and then stole a glance at Sweeney Todd, who looked as impenetrable and destitute of all emotion as a block of wood. Missing, Mr. John Rankly, tobacconist, of 92 Fleet Street. The above gentleman left his home to go over the water on business, and has not been since heard of. He is supposed to have had some valuable property with him, in the shape of a string of pearls. The said Mr. John Rankly is 5 feet 4 inches high, full face, short thick nose, black whiskers, and what is commonly called a bullet head, thick set and skittle made, not very well upon his feet, and whoever will give any information of him at 92 Fleet Street shall be amply rewarded. Yes, yes, said Mrs. Rankly, when the reading of the bill was finished. That's him to a T, my poor, dear, handsome Rankly. Oh, I shall never be myself again. I have not eaten anything since he went out.
Then buy a pie, madam, said Todd, as he held one close to her. Look up, Mrs. Rankly. Lift off the top crust, madam, and you may take my word for it, you will soon see something of Mr. Rankly.
The hideous face that Todd made during the utterance of these words quite alarmed the disconsolate widow, but she did partake of the pie for all that. It was very tempting, a veal one, full of coagulated gravy. Who could resist it? Not she, certainly. And besides, did not Todd say she would see something of Rankly? There was hope in his words, at all events, if nothing else. Well, she said, I will hope for the best. He may have been taken ill and not have had his address in his pocket, poor dear soul, at the time.
And at all events, madam, said Todd, you need not be cut up about it, you know. I dare say you will know what has become of him some day soon.
End of chapter 36.
Chapter 37 of String of Pearls. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Hui Jin. The String of Pearls. Author unknown. Chapter 37. The Prisoner's Plan of Escape from the Pies. Mrs. Lovett was a woman of judgment, and when she told Sweeney Todd that the prisoner was getting impatient in the lower regions of the house, which was devoted to the manufacture of the delicious pies, she had guessed rightly his sensation with regard to his present state and future prospects. We last left that unfortunate young man lying upon the floor of the place where the steaming and tempting manufacture was carried on, and for a time, as a very natural consequence of exhaustion, he slept profoundly. That sleep, however, if it rested him bodily, likewise rested him mentally, and when he again awoke, it was but to feel more acutely the agony of his most singular and cruel situation. There was a clock in the place by which he had been enabled to accurately regulate the time that the various batches of pies should take in cooking, and upon looking up to that, he saw that it was upon the hour of 6, and consequently it would be 3 hours more before a batch of pies was wanted. He looked about him very mournfully for some time, and then he spoke. "What evil destiny," he said, "has placed me here? Oh, how much better it would have been if I had perished, as I have been near perishing several times during the period of my eventful life, than that I should be shut up in this horrible den and starve to death, as in all human probability I shall be, for I loathe the pies. Damn the pies!" There was a slight noise, and upon his raising his eyes to that part of the place near the roof, where there were some iron bars and between which Mrs. Lovett was wont to give him some directions, he saw her now detested face. "Attend," she said. "You will bake an extra batch tonight, at 9 precisely." "What?"
An extra batch, 200 at least. Do you understand me? Hark ye, Mrs. Lovett, you are carrying this sort of thing too far. It won't do, I tell you, Mrs. Lovett. I don't know how soon I may be numbered with the dead, but as I'm a living man now, it will make no more of your detestable pies. Beware, beware yourself. I'm not one to be frightened at shadows. I say I will leave this place, whether you like it or not. I will leave it, and perhaps you will find your power insufficient to keep me here. That there is some frightful mystery at the bottom of all the proceeding here, I'm certain, but you shall not make me the victim of it. Rash fool! Very well. Say what you like, but remember I defied you. Then you are tired of your life, and you will find, when too late, what are the consequences of your defiance. But listen to me. When I first engaged you, I told you you might leave when you were tired of the employment. You did, and yet you keep me a prisoner here. God knows I'm tired enough of it. Besides, I shall starve, for I cannot eat pies eternally. I hate them, and they so admired. Yes, when one end surfeited with them. I'm now only subsisting upon baked flour. I cannot eat the pies. You are strangely fantastical. Perhaps I am. Do you live upon pies? I should like to know, Mrs. Lovett. That is altogether beside the question. You shall, if you like, leave this place tomorrow morning, by which time I hope to have got someone else to take over your situation. But I cannot be left without anyone to make the pies. I don't care for that. I won't make another one. We shall see, said Mrs. Lovett. I will come to you in an hour and see if you persevere in that determination. I advise you, as a friend, to change, for you will most bitterly repent standing in the way of your own enfranchisement. Well, but she is gone, and what can I do? I'm in her power, but should I tamely submit? No, no. Not while I have my arms at liberty, and strength enough to wield one of these long pokers that stir the coals in the ovens. How foolish of me, not to think before that I had such desperate weapons, with which, perchance, to work my way to freedom. As he spoke, he poised in his hand one of the long pokers he spoke of, and after some few minutes spent in consideration, he said to himself, with something of the cheerfulness of hope, I'm in Bell Yard, and there are houses right and left of this accursed pie shop, and those houses must have cellars. Now, surely with such a weapon as this, a willing heart and an arm that has not yet quite lost all its powers, I may make my way from this abominable abode. The very thought of thus achieving his liberty lent him new strength and resolution, so that he felt himself to be quite a different man to what he had been, and he only paused to consider in which direction it would be best to begin his work. After some reflection upon that head, he considered that it would be better to commence where the meat was kept, that meat of which he always found abundance, and which came from he knew not where, since, if he went to sleep with little or none of it, upon the shelf where it was placed for use, he always found plenty when he awoke. Yes, he said, I will begin there, and work my way to freedom. Before, however, he commenced operations, he glanced at the clock and found that it wanted very little now to 7, so that he thought it would be but common prudence to wait until Mrs. Lovett had paid him her promised visit, as then, if he said he would make the pies she required, he would, in all probability, be left to himself for 2 hours, and he thought, if he did not make good progress in that time toward his liberty,
"It would be strange indeed." He sat down and patiently waited until 7 o'clock. Scarcely had the hour sounded when he heard the voice of his tormentor and mistress at the grating. "Well," she said, "have you considered?" "Oh, yes, I have. Need must, you know, Mrs. Lovett, when a certain person drives. But I have a great favor to ask of you, madame." "What is it?" "Why, I feel faint, and if you could let me have a pot of porter, I would undertake to make a batch of pies superior to any you have ever had, and without any grumbling either." Mrs. Lovett was silent for a few moments, and then said, "If you are supplied with porter, will you continue in your situation?" "Well, I don't know that, but perhaps I may. At all events, I will make you the 9 o'clock batch, you may depend." "Very well, you shall have it." She disappeared at these words, and in about 10 minutes a small trap door opened in the roof, and there was let down by a cord a foaming pot of porter. "This is capital," cried the victim of the pies, as he took half of it at a draught. "This is nectar for the gods." "Oh, what a relief, to be sure. It puts new life into me." And so it really seemed, for shouldering the poker, which was more like a javelin than anything else, he at once rushed into the vault where the meat was kept. "Now," he said, "for a grand effort at freedom. And if I succeed, I promised you, Mrs. Lovett, that I will come round to the shop and rather surprise you, madame. Damn the pies." We have before described the place in which the meat was kept, and we need now only say that the shelves were very well stocked indeed, and that our friend, in whose progress we have a great interest, shoveled off the large pieces with celerity from one of the shelves and commenced operations with the poker. He was not slow in discovering that his work would not be the most easy in the world, for every now and then he kept encountering what felt very much like a plate of iron, but he fecked away with right good will, and succeeded after a time in getting down one of the shelves, which was 1 point gained at all events. "Now for it," he said, "now for it. I shall be able to act, to work upon the wall itself, and it must be something unusually strong to prevent me making a breach through it soon." In order to refresh himself, he finished the porter, and then, using his javelin-like poker as a battering ram, he banged the wall with the end of it for some moments, without producing any effect, until suddenly a portion of it swung open just like a door, and he paused to wonder how that came about. All was darkness through the aperture, and yet he saw that it was actually a little square door that he had knocked open. And the idea then recurred to him that he had found how the shelves were supplied with meat, and he had no doubt that there was such a little square door opening at the back of every one of them. "So," he said, "that mystery is solved. But what part of Mrs. Lovett's premises have I got upon now?" "We shall soon see." He went boldly into the large cellar and produced a light, a flaming torch, made of a piece of dry wood, and returning to the opening he had made in the wall, he thrust his head through it and projected the torch before him. With a cry of horror, he fell backwards, extinguishing the torch in his fall, and he lay for a full quarter of an hour insensible upon the floor. What dreadful sight had he seen that had so chilled his young blood and frozen up the springs of life? When he recovered, he looked around him in the dim borrowed light that came from the other vault, and he shuddered as he said, "Was it a dream?" Soon, however, as he rose, he gave up the idea of having been the victim of any delusion of the imagination, for there was the broken shelf, and there the little square opening through which he had looked and seen what had so transfixed him with horror. Keeping his face in that direction, as if it would be dreadful to turn his back for a moment upon some frightful object, he made his way into the larger cellar where the ovens were, and then he sat down with a deep groan. "What should I do? Oh, what should I do?" he muttered. "I'm doomed, doomed." "Are the pies doing?" said the voice of Mrs. Lovett. "It's 8 o'clock." "8, is it?" "Yes, to be sure. And I want to know if you are bent upon your own destruction or not. I don't hear the furnace going, and I'm quite sure you have not made the pies." "Oh, I will keep my word, madame. You may depend. You want 200 pies at 9 o'clock, and you will see that they shall come up quite punctually, to the minute." "Very good. I'm glad you are better satisfied than you were." "I'm quite satisfied now, Mrs. Lovett. I am quite in a different mood of mind to what I was before, I can assure you, madame, that I have no complaints to make, and I think the place has done me some good, and if at 9 o'clock you let down the platform, you shall have 200 pies up, as sure as fate, and something else too," he added to himself, "or I shall be of a very different mind to what I now am." We have already seen that Mrs. Lovett was not deceived by this seeming submission on the part of the cook, for she used that as an argument with Todd when she was expatiating upon the necessity of getting rid of him that night. But the cleverest people make mistakes at times, and probably when the 9 o'clock batch of pies make its appearance, something will occur at the same time which will surprise a great many more persons than Mrs. Lovett and the reader. But we must not anticipate, merely saying with the Eastern sage, "What will be, and what's impossible don't often come to pass." Certain it is that the 9 o'clock batch of 200 pies were made and put in the ovens, and equally certain is it that the cook remarked as he did so, "Yes, I'll do it. It may succeed. Nay, it must succeed. And if so, woe be to you, Mrs. Lovett, and all who are joined with you in this horrible speculation, at which I sicken." End of chapter 37. Recording by Hui Jin.
Chapter 38 of The String of Pearls. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by M.W. Jackson. The String of Pearls, author unknown, Chapter 38. Johanna is still alone in the barber's shop. Her head is resting upon her hands, and she is thinking of times gone past, when she had hoped for happiness with Mark Industry. When we say alone, we must not be presumed to have forgotten the two officers who were so snugly packed in the cupboard. But Johanna, as her mind wandered back to her last interview with him whom she had loved so well and clung to so fondly and so constantly, almost for a time forgot where she was and that there was such a person as Sweeney Todd in existence. "Alas, alas," she said, "it seems likely enough that by the adoption of this disguise, so unsuited to me, I may achieve vengeance, but nothing more. Where are you, Mark Industry?" "Oh, horror! Something seems to tell me that no mortal voice can answer me." Tears came trickling to her relief, and as she felt them trickling through her fingers, she started as she thought that the hour which Todd had said would expire before he returned must have nearly gone. "I must control these thoughts," she said, "and this emotion. I must seem that which I am not." She rose and ceased weeping. She trimmed the little miserable lamp, and then she was about to go to the door to look for the return of Todd, when that individual, with a slow and sneaking footstep, made his appearance, as if he had been hiding just within the doorway. Todd hung his hat upon a peg, and then, turning his eyes inquiringly upon Johanna, he said, "Well, has anyone been?" "Yes." "Who?" "Speak, speak out. Confound you, you mumble so I can hardly hear you." "A gentleman to be shaved, and he went away again. I don't know what puts you in such a passion, Mr. Todd. I'm sure nothing. What is it to you? Get out of my way, will you? And you may begin to think of shutting up, I think, for we shall have no more customers tonight. I am tired and weary. You are to sleep under the counter, you know." "Yes, sir, you told me so. I dare say I shall be very comfortable there." "And you have not been peeping and prying about, have you?" "Not at all." "Not looking even into that cupboard, I suppose, eh? It's not locked, but that's no reason why you should look into it. Not that there is any secret in it, but I object to peeping and prying upon principle." Todd, as he spoke, advanced towards the cupboard, and Johanna thought in another moment a discovery would undoubtedly take place of the two officers who were there concealed, and probably that would have been the case had not the handle of the shop door been turned at that moment, and a man presented himself, at which Todd turned quickly, and saw that he was a substantial-looking farmer with dirty top boots, as if he had just come off a journey. "Well, master," said the visitor, "I want a clean shave." "Oh," said Todd, not in the best of humors, "it's rather late. I suppose you would not like to wait till morning, for I don't know if I have any hot water." "Oh, cold will do." "Cold? Oh dear, no. We never shave in cold water. But if you must, you must. So, sit down, sir, and we will soon settle the business." "Thank you, thank you. I can't go to bed comfortable without a clean shave, do you see? I have come up from Braintree with beasts on commission, and I'm staying at the Bull's Head, you see." "Oh, indeed," said Todd, as he adjusted the shaving cloth. "The Bull's Head." "Yes, master. Why, I brought up a matter of 220 beasts, I did, do you see, and was on my pony, as good a stepper as you'd wish to see. And I sold them all, do you see, for 550 pun. Ho, ho, good work that, do you see. And only 42 on 'em was my beasts, do you see. I've got a missus at home, and a daughter. My girl's named Johanna." Up to this point, Johanna had not suspected that the game had begun, and this was the magistrate who had come to put an end to the malpractices of Sweeney Todd. But his marked pronunciation of her name at once opened her eyes to the fact, and she knew that something interesting must soon happen. "And so you sold them all?" said Todd. "Yes, master, I did, and I've got the money in my pocket now, in banknotes. I never leave my money about at inns, do you see, master. Safe find, you see. I carries it about with me." "A good plan, too," said Todd. "Charlie, some hot water. That's a good lad. And Charlie."
"Yes, sir."
"While I am finishing off this gentleman, you may as well just run to the Temple to Master Sergeant Toldrinus and ask for his wig. We shall have to do it in the morning, and may as well have it the first thing in the day to begin upon. And you need not hurry, Charlie, as we shall shut up when you come back." Johanna walked out, but would no further than the shop window, close to which she placed her eyes so that, between a pomatum jar and a lot of hair brushes, she could clearly see what was going on. "A nice-looking little lad, that," said Todd's customer.
"Very, sir, an orphan boy. I took him out of charity. Poor little fellow. But there, we ought to try to do all the good we can."
"Just so. I'm glad I have come to be shaved here. Mine's a rather strong beard, I think, do you see?
Why, sir, in a manner of speaking, replied Todd, it is a strong beard. I suppose you didn't come to London alone, sir?
Oh, yes, quite alone. Except the drovers, I had no company with me. Why do you ask?
Why, sir, I thought if you had any gentlemen with you who might be waiting at the Bull's Head, you would recommend them to me if anything was wanting in my way, you know, sir. You might have just left him, saying you were going to Todd, the barber's, to have a clean shave, sir.
No, not at all. The fact is, I did not come out to have a shave, but a walk, and it wasn't till I gave my chin a stroke and found that a beard I had that I thought of it. And then, passing your shop, in I popped, do you see?
Exactly, sir. I comprehend. You are quite alone in London.
Oh, quite. But when I come again, I'll come to you to be shaved, you may depend, and I'll recommend you, too.
I'm very much obliged to you, said Todd, as he passed his hand over the chin of his customer.
I'm very much obliged. I find I must give you another lather, sir, and I'll get another razor with a keener edge, now that I have taken off all the rough, as one may say, in a manner of speaking.
Oh, I shall do.
No, no, don't move, sir. I shall not detain you a moment. I have my other razors in the next room, and will polish you off now, sir, before you know where you are. You know, sir, you have promised to recommend me, so I must do the best I can with you.
Well, well, a clean shave is a comfort, but don't be long, for I want to get back, do you see?
Not a moment, not a moment. Sweeney Todd walked into his back parlor, conveying with him the only light that was in the shop, so that the dim glimpse that, up to this time, Johanna from the outside had contrived to get of what was going on, was denied to her, and all that met her eyes was impenetrable darkness. Oh, what a world of anxious, agonizing sensations crossed the mind of the young and beautiful girl at that moment. She felt as if some great crisis in her history had arrived, and that she was condemned to look in vain into the darkness to see of what it consisted. We must not, however, allow the reader to remain in the same state of mystification which came over the perceptive faculties of Joanna Oakley, but we shall proceed to state clearly and distinctly what did happen in the barber's shop while he went to get an uncommonly keen razor in his back parlor. The moment his back was turned, the seeming farmer, who had made such a good thing of his beasts, sprang from his shaving chair, as if he had been electrified, and yet he did not do it with any appearance of fright, nor did he make any noise. It was only astonishingly quick, and then he placed himself close to the window and waited patiently, with his eyes fixed upon the chair, to see what would happen next. In the space of about a quarter of a minute, there came from the next room a sound like the rapid drawing of a heavy bolt, and then in an instant the shaving chair disappeared beneath the floor, and the circumstances by which Sweeney Todd's customers disappeared was evident. There was a piece of the floor turning upon a center, and the weight of the chair, when a bolt was withdrawn by means of a simple leverage from the inner room, weighed down upon one end of the top, which, by a little apparatus, was to swing completely around, there being another chair on the under surface, which thus became the upper, exactly resembling the one in which the unhappy customer was supposed to be polished off. Hence was it that in one moment, as if by magic, Sweeney Todd's visitors disappeared, and there was the empty chair. No doubt he trusted to a fall of about 20 feet below, onto a stone floor, to be the death of them, or at all events, to stun them until he could go down to finish the murder, and to cut them up from Mrs. Lovett's pies, after robbing them of all money and valuables they might have about them. In another moment, the sound as of a bolt was heard again, and Sir Richard Blunt, who had played the part of the wealthy farmer, feeling that the trap was closed again, seated himself in the new chair that had made its appearance with all the nonchalance in life as if nothing had happened. It was a full minute before Todd ventured to look from the parlor into the darkened shop, and then he shook so that he had to hold the door to steady himself. "That's done," he said. "That's the last, I hope. It is time I finished. I never felt so nervous since the first time. Then I did quake a little. How quiet he went. I have sometimes had a shriek ringing in my ears for a whole week." It was a large, high-backed piece of furniture, that shaving chair, so that, when Todd crept into the shop with the light in his hand, he had not the slightest idea it was tenanted. But when he got around it, and saw his customer calmly waiting with the lather upon his face, the cry of horror that came gargling and gushing from his throat was horrible to hear. "Why, what's the matter?" said Sir Richard. "Oh, God, the dead, oh, God," cried Todd. "This is the beginning of my punishment. Have mercy, heaven. Oh, do not look upon me with those dead eyes." "Murderer!" shouted Sir Richard, in a voice that rang like the blast of a trumpet through the house. In an instant, he sprang upon Sweeney Todd, and grappled him by the throat. There was a short struggle, and they were down upon the floor together. But Todd's wrists were suddenly laid hold of, and a pair of handcuffs were scientifically put upon him by the officers, who, at the word murderer, that being a preconcerted signal, came from the cupboard where they had been concealed. "Secure him well, my men," said the magistrate, "and don't let him lay violent hands upon himself." "Ah, Miss Oakley, you are in time. This man is a murderer. I found out all the secret about the chair last night, after 12, by exploring the vaults under the old church. Thank God, we have stopped his career." End of chapter 38.
Chapter 39 of The String of Pearls. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or how to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. The String of Pearls by Author Unknown. Chapter 39, The Conclusion. It wants 5 minutes to nine, and Mrs. Lovett's shop is filling with persons anxious to devour or to carry away one or more of the 9 o'clock batch of savory, delightful, gushing gravy pies. Many of Mrs. Lovett's customers paid her in advance for the pies in order that they might be quite sure of getting their orders fulfilled when the first batch should make its gracious appearance from the depths below. "Well, Jiggs," said one of the legal fraternity to another, "how are you today, old fellow? What do you bring it in?" "Oh, I ain't very blooming. The fact is, the Count and I, and a few others, made a night of it last evening, and somehow or another, I don't think whiskey and water, half and half, and tribe go together. I should wonder if they did. And so I've come for a pie just to settle me stomach, you see. I'm rather delicate." "Ah, you are just like me, young man, there," said an elderly patronage. "I have a delicate stomach, and the slightest thing disagrees with me. A mere idea will make me quite ill." "Will it really?" "Yes, and my wife, she..." "Oh, bother your wife. It's only 5 minutes to nine, don't you see? What a crowd there is, to be sure. Mrs. Lovett, you charmer, I hope you have ordered enough pies to be made tonight. You see what a lot of customers you have." "Oh, there will be plenty. That's right, I say, don't push so. You'll be in time, I tell you. Don't be pushing and shoving in that sort of way. I've got ribs." "And so have I. Last night, I didn't get to bed at all, and my old woman is in a certain condition, you see, gentlemen, and won't fancy anything but one of Lovett's veal pies, and so I've come all the way from Newington to get one for..." "Hold your row, will you? And don't push, for to have the child mocked as a pie, is it? Behind there, I say. Don't be pushing a fellow, as if it was half price at a theatre. Each moment added some newcomers to the throng, and at last any strangers who had known nothing of the attractions of Mrs. Lovett's pie shop had walked down Bell Yard would have been astonished at the throng of persons there assembled, a throng that was each moment increasing in density and becoming more and more urgent and clamorous. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. Yes, it is 9 at last. It strikes by All St. Dunstan's church clock, and in weaker strains the chronometrical machine at the pie shop echoes the sound. What excitement there is now to get at the pies when they shall come. Mrs. Lovett lets down the square movable platform that goes upon pulleys into the cellar. Some machinery which only requires a handle to be turned brings up 100 pies in a try. These are eagerly seized by parties who have previously paid, and such a smacking of lips ensues as never was known. Down goes the platform for the next 100, and a gentlemanly man says, "Let me work the handle, Mrs. Lovett, if you please. It's too much for you, I'm sure." "Sir, you are very kind, but I'd never allow anybody on this side of the counter but me own people, sir. I could turn the handle myself, sir, if you please, with the assistance of this girl." "Keep your distance, sir. Nobody wants your help." How the waggish young lawyer's clerks laughed as they smacked their lips and sucked in the gloptious gravy of the pies, which, by the by, appeared to be all delicious veal this time, and Mrs. Lovett worked the handle of the machine all the more vigorously that she was a little angry with the officious stranger. What an unusual trouble it seemed to be to wind up those forthcoming 100 pies! How she toiled, and how the people waited, but at length there came up the savory steam, and then the tops of the pies were visible. They came upon a large tray about 6 feet square, and the moment Mrs. Lovett ceased turning the handle and let a catch fall that prevented the platform receding again, to the astonishment and terror of everyone, away flew all the pies, tray and all, across the counter, and a man who was lying crouched down in an exceedingly flat state under the tray sprang to his feet. Mrs. Lovett shrieked as well she might, and then she stood trembling and looked as pale as death itself. It was the doomed cook from the cellars who had adopted this mode of escape. The throngs of persons in the shop looked petrified, and after Mrs. Lovett's shriek there was an awful stillness for about a minute, and then the young man who officiated as cook spoke. "Ladies and gentlemen, I fear that what I am going to say will spoil your appetites. But the truth is beautiful at all times, and I have to state that Mrs. Lovett's pies are made of human flesh." How the throng of persons recoiled! What a roar of agony and dismay there was! How frightfully sick about 40 lawyers' clerks became all at once, and how they spat out the gelatinous clinging portions of the rich pies they had been devouring. "Good gracious! Oh, the pies! Confound it!" "'Tis false!" screamed Mrs. Lovett. "You are my prisoner, madam," said the man, who had obligingly offered to turn the handle of the machine that wound up the pies, at the same time producing a constable's staff. "Prisoner!" "Yes, on a charge of aiding and abetting Sweeney Todd, now in custody at the commission of many murders." Mrs. Lovett staggered back, and her complexion turned a livid color. "I am poisoned," she said. "Good God, I am poisoned," and she sank insensible to the floor. There was now some confusion at the door of the shop, for several people were effecting an entrance. These consisted of Sir Richard Blunt, Colonel Jeffrey, Joanna Oakley, and Tobias Ragg, who, when he escaped from the madhouse at Peckham Rye, went directly to a gentleman in the Temple who took him to the magistrate. "Miss Oakley," said Sir Richard, "you objected to coming here, but I told you I had a particular reason for bringing you. This night, about half an hour since, I made an acquaintance I want to introduce you to." "Who? Oh, who?" "There's an underground communication all the way from Sweeney Todd's cellar to the ovens of this pie shop, and I found there Mrs. Lovett's cook, with whom I arranged this little surprise for his mistress. Look at him, Mrs. Oakley. Do you know him? Look up, Master Cook." Mark and Jestry," shrieked Joanna the moment she glanced at the person alluded to. "Joanna!" In another moment she was in his arms and clasped to his heart. "Oh, Mark, you are not dead." No, I never was. "And you, Joanna, are not in love with the fellow in military undress you met in the Temple?" No, I never was. When Mrs. Lovett was picked up by the officers, she was found to be dead. The poison which Sweeney Todd had put into the brandy she was accustomed to solace herself with when the pangs of conscience troubled her, and of which she always took some before the evening batch of pies came up, had done its work. That night, Todd passed a Newgate, and in due time a swinging corpse was all that remained of the barber of Fleet Street. Mr. Fogg's establishment at Peckham Rye was broken up, and that gentleman persuaded to emigrate, for which the government kindly paid all expenses. Tobias went into the service of Mark and Jestry, and, at the marriage of Mark with his beautiful bride, Big Ben, the beef-eater, did some extraordinary things which space and opportunity will not permit us to chronicle in these pages. The youths who visited Lovett's pie shop and there luxuriated upon those delicacies are youths no longer. Indeed, the grave has closed over all but one, and he is very, very old. But even now, as he thinks of how he enjoyed the flavor of the veal, he shudders and has to take a drop of brandy. Beneath the old church of Sundustons were found the heads and bones of Todd's victims. As little as possible was said by the authorities about it, but it was supposed that some hundreds of persons must have perished in the frightful manner we have detailed. Our tale is over, and the only seeming mystery that has to be explained consists in settling the point with regard to who Thornhill was and what became of him. It was just what he resented himself to be, the friend of Mark and Jestry, to whom had been by Mark entrusted the care of the String of Pearls. But he fell a victim to the awful criminality of Sweeney Todd, who was in league with Mrs. Lovett, and who robbed his murdered customers while she sold them for pies. Mark and Jestry, after many dangers and hardships, had reached London. But he did so, unfortunately, only just in time to follow Joanna to the Temple Gardens in one of her innocent ramblings with Colonel Jeffrey. But believing from that circumstance that she was false to him, and hearing nothing of his friend Thornhill, he, in a moment of despair, took the desperate situation of cook at Mrs. Lovett's far-famed pie shop, from where he so narrowly escaped with his life. Joanna and Mark lived long and happily together, enjoying all the comforts of an independent existence, but they never forgot the strange and eventful circumstances connected with the String of Pearls. End of chapter 39. Recording by Aaron Elliott, St. Louis, Missouri. End of The String of Pearls by author unknown.
Ohio seniors, make the right call for better Medicare benefits with Medical Mutual. Call 1-866-966-9338 to find a plan today. Enroll by December 7th.